Accession number 27804, Squadron Leader Ian Blair, Reel 28. Now, you said there was one other issue that arose during your time at the MOD, Department E29.
Yes. At this period of time, somewhere between 57 and 58, we had this trouble going on in the Middle East with the Israelis and the Egyptians, I think it's around about then, but it had been the decision of air staff to discontinue the use of rockets, that's the 3-inch rockets, on fighter aircraft. Even during the Aden crisis, I think it had petered out, to say it to you. And we had been given, at E29, instructions to dispose of all the 3-inch rockets. Well, we went through the system for whatever long it took, or however long it took, and we flogged, I use that phrase for that, we sold to the Dutch government 10,000 rockets, rocket motors. And suddenly, we got rid of them, they'd gone, and suddenly we got this murmur that they wanted rockets for the Hunter aircraft, which were in Cyprus. And they knew that the pilots hadn't been rocket trained, so they wanted to, somebody in the air staff wanted to hang rockets on these Hunters and let them fire them off one at a time. And I said at the time, look, they can't do that on the current mechanism we got on the Hunters. They got to go off in pairs. Oh, that means twice the consumption. Well, nevertheless, that's what it had to be. And there was, apparently, rumor has it, I got this from the wing commander, that the air staff officer in the air council were getting a bit anti with each other. But anyway, in the push came to shove, we finally were instructed to buy back from Holland, from the Dutch rather, these 10,000 round rockets and ship them out to Cyprus. Well, I suppose they went eventually. But I don't know the end, what the outcome. I suppose the trouble petered out. And that, there was also another incident at the same time was with the Canberra aircraft. They'd just gone on to a new 2-inch rocket pod on the Canberras in Germany, German Canberra B-8s, I think. And I went to one of these meetings that we were want to go to at MOD, E29, a modification committee meeting. And they were sitting around the table discussing these rockets and things. And the engineer, the technical armament engineer, said, oh, yes, he said, we'll be hanging these rocket pods on each of the wings, but the wings will have to be modified. At which juncture, I remember the finance guy getting up and saying, what modification is this? So they had a quick deliberation, and apparently there was a modification required for the strengthening of the wings of the Canberra to carry these rockets. And this mod, cost-wise, was going to cost about 24,000 quid for each aircraft. Whereupon there was the meeting was suspended at that point. I think, in actual fact, the modification was cut. The rockets hadn't arrived, actually, but they were almost coming off the production line at that time. They obviously had modified the aircraft subsequently. But that was the type of thing that we came up against, or I came up against. Another similar thing was a fire extinguisher in the Vulcan aircraft. They had a cartridge which operated electrically operated cartridge in the Vulcans, which initiated the fire extinguisher system. And it was at Simlon meeting, Mod's aircraft meeting, that the Mark II cartridge was discussed and approved, and somebody threw the hat into the ground, into the middle, saying, "Ah, well, but the electrical system on the Vulcan is not capable of carrying the current that you need for this cartridge." Again, utter consternation. Why these types of things had to wait, I was never considered. Just an oversight, I presume. But those were things that went through the system. So having said all that, I didn't like E-29, basically.
Why didn't you like it?
Pardon?
Why didn't you?
Well, because it was there was nothing really interesting coming out of it. I was just getting returns from the Far East and sending signals saying, why haven't you sent your returns? And the occasional trip out was the only item of any great interest. I was only there a short time, really. I felt I could have been better. But my posting came in October 59, and I accepted that. It was a posting to RAF Salita in Singapore, and that was good, because this time I was able to take my family with me, and I embarked on the HMT Oxfordshire, and had a very nice, I think it took 32 days sail out. It was quite good. As an officer, we were much better. I had a family with me and my kids with me, so, and yeah, we had a good, it was great, because it was a long drag, 32 days, and it was, we managed to observe, in the early hours of the morning, observe our married quarters at Devoswar on the canal zone. As we went through the canal, we could see it in the distance. It looked just the same after all these years. And my kids seemed to enjoy it. Then it was very hot at Aden, and then subsequently we went to Colombo. We stayed there, and we went ashore there for a day. I eventually finished up in Singapore. When arrived on the 5th of November, Guy Fawkes Night. So I think it would be prudent just to finish there for this session. Arrived the 5th of November, I was disembarked, and I was posted to 389MU at Salita.
Now, what happened when you joined 389MU at Salita?
Well, I was at 389MU. I was given a job of in a section which was responsible for stock control of such things as the armament spares, electrical spares, photographic spares, aircraft engines. Was about the main, as far as I can remember. The important thing was that the
so less than explosives.
This was my posting was to the position of Air 2, which was a one of the sections of the stock control office. My boss, when I got there, was a woman. First time I'd encountered a squadron leader as an officer. She was a nice lady. I liked her. I didn't have any, you know, people always used to working for a woman. I didn't have any trouble. I just took it as I found it, and I got on all right. What was that? I kept in touch with her over years, but she died. She was at Andover last time I met her. But the job, as I said, consisted of stock control. As my section dealt with the armament section predominantly. And it was before computer days, all the stock records were manually held on cards. So you had to look through the cards and pick up the details. And radio was another major section, section 10. We had to order back from UK bits and pieces, and at the same time we had to repair. We had a sister MU called 390 MU, which was exclusively a signals repair organization. So it was a normal store's job, and you were monitoring the stock levels, the issue of items against demands for units. We had reserve holdings, particularly for Bomber Command. Bomber Command, we used to have major, what they call pack-ups for reserves in the event of Bomber Command being deployed. And Bomber Command deployment base was Butterworth, which is way up other side of Kuala Lumpur, or near Kuala Lumpur. But we had pack-ups, but the Bomber Command units worked literally independently. They were self-contained. Only on occasions, if we got a requirement for a piece of equipment, if we had it in our pack-up, then we had to get special approval from our group headquarters to issue the items. The great advantage of Singapore was that you were 8 hours in advance, so anything that happened today, if you put the requirement back to UK, arrived in the middle of the night, it was dealt with the following day in UK, and the item can be back out to you in 24 hours. I really mean that. It was not an unusual feature to order an item today, and the item would be delivered the following day, 24 hours later. They had a marvelous, although it was expensive in general terms, it was very, very good. Now, the communication from UK to the Far East was dealt with through a teleprinter system, and it was all based at Hendon. Yeah, Hendon. So when you put your orders in at one end, it was converted into punch paper tape and transmitted. And it came out at Hendon in punch paper tape and the reverse procedure. This was the forerunner of the computer control system as we know it, or knew it, got to know it. When I was I hadn't actually reached the computer age yet. It was my next tour that I got involved in this, but I did see this system in operation, and it was done on. The stock recording was done on a cash machine, which typed the information onto the cards, and then you transmitted the signals to UK as and when necessary. So that was the toing and froing, and you kept on reviewing the thing. There's two things I remember about the actual nuts and bolts of the job. Was I was obviously, being an armourer, I was interested in the armament range, and we had manuscript reserve holdings of items on these cards, and I used to dig a bunch of cards out and look through them, and I always remember the Bren guns. There was a reference number for a Bren gun, and it said reserve holdings 365. I remember this. I said, oh, that looks, and when I looked on, I found that, sure enough, we had 365 Bren guns, but we had nothing else to support it. So I went to the regiment guy, and I said, have you got your list of spares for the Bren guns? They said, yeah, here's the publication. So I took it away and had a look at it, and it had such things like spare barrel, spare magazines, magazine carriers, pouch carrying for carrying, all sorts of things, springs. So I got all the reference numbers, and I went through all the stock, and lo and behold, there was nothing on any of the stock. In other words, there were 360 Bren guns, full stop, and no spare barrels or spare anything, spare magazines. So I went to the wing commander and said, through the commander, I said, look, this is ridiculous. If you're going to hold 365 Bren guns in reserve, then you've got to hold the supporting spares. He said, oh, that's perfectly right. So I said, well, what shall I do? Do you want me to order? He said, oh, yeah, you better order. So I indented for all these things eventually. That was one thing. There was another similar item, which I can't quite remember the substance of it, but it was holding, oh, yeah, it was holding 20-millimeter cannons in reserve. And for some reason, they had a figure. I said, but we haven't got an aircraft that has these anymore in the command. I said, what shall we do? So we got rid of them. And they said, oh, yeah, I got rid of them. And the last item that really struck me was they were holding such things as main planes for obsolescent types of aircraft. I think we had one Meteor in the command, and they had spare fuel tanks and spare main planes for this one Meteor. And I think they even had a Wellington main plane. And we know Wellington's in the command. So this type of thing I sort of processed over the time and got rid of them. The next thing that I came up against, we would get from the Ministry of Defence, we'd get a full task spelling out all the nuts and bolts which were coming to us, but never gave us any dates when they were coming. So I managed to analyse this and go through this and say to command, well, look, all these tasks, when I say tasks, they were all signals plans, introducing new signals equipment. And some of it was quite voluminous. On one occasion, there were 25 vehicles turned up from the port, from the Singapore docks, and we didn't even know that stuff was coming. And I managed to streamline that system by getting initial advice from through the system of from MOD as what equipment was being provided, when it was being shipped, and what it was for. And by analysing that, we knew how much storage space we had, because some of these equipments were coming out years, literally years in advance of when the projects were to be established. That was a big thing. I managed to cope with that quite well, actually. And eventually, the other thing was we had it on base a special radar unit. And it was a one-off. And so anything that the unit needed, there was no reference number to it, obviously. You had to describe it verbally. So I went to see this guy, and I said, look, you must have this information somewhere. And what happens is when they create these, they draw up a schedule of procurement, for want of a better expression, where all the units, all the contractors, all the people who supply the equipment are identified, and the equipment is identified, and the number off is identified, and then eventually it's procured and sent to an MU, and then it's assembled into an operating radar unit and then shipped out. So I said, well, when I analysed all this, I had about 17 of these things. So I wrote to the wing commander, who was an Australian actually at the headquarters, and I said, look, this is making our life very difficult. We don't know A, when the items are coming and so on, B, what size of storage we need, and etc. And we should make provision for this. So he wrote back to MOD, and we managed to sort it out, so we got all the information in advance. But the important feature was this prototype gizmo that we had. We got the schedule of procurement, the schedule from UK, which identified the manufacturers and the part numbers and all the other, so that when a guy came to me and said, I've got this piece, is unserviceable, I could immediately identify it. He could point it out to me on the schedule, and we could order it. And this worked really well, because, you know, to without without the knowledge, detailed knowledge, to try to identify a piece of equipment word-wise was quite an achievement. Anyway, we managed to work through that system. Then we had another system of where the teleprinter equipment was all not available. We had this MU which repaired teleprinters, and they were really in trouble because they couldn't get the components. And I went through this with the guy, and I said, well, why can't we just order the parts? He said, well, we've never ordered the parts before. We've always ordered a complete item. Oh, I said, well, so I said, let's try it. So we put in a requirement for parts, and it came through quick, almost came like a flash, came out through very quickly. They were all minute pieces of, anyway, that was another achievement. And on the whole, I enjoyed it there very much. We had a new doctrine on priority demands, where we had to order, we had to be very careful because everything came by air. And I remember the guy who was doing an installation of the radar equipment at one of the local airports, coming, say he wanted 1,500 yards in these days of cable, special cable for this radar installation. So I said, yeah, okay. So I went and looked it up. It was on a great big cable ream about 8 feet in diameter. It weighed, you know, thousands of pounds. So I said to this guy, I said, look, you've put the top priority. This means it's got to be shipped by air. Do you really need this to come out by air? He said, oh, yeah, I need that. I said, well, look, I'll have to refer this to the group, the headquarters, because they've put an embargo on airlifts. So the wing commander, equipper, obviously spoke to the appropriate people, and he said, yeah, it's okay, put it in as a priority airlift. So I demanded this thing on UK, and they had to charter a Britannia. I'm not kidding. They had to charter a Britannia to bring this thing out. It was the only aircraft that could get the equipment in. Anyway, Julia arrived, you know, at a very quick time, as one would have expected, and it was whisked off to this guy. And that was one. And then there was a guy ordered a rudder assembly for a Shackleton. And we had a Shackleton on the pitch for disposal up on the site. So this guy flashed off a signal for a Shackleton rudder complete, which is another big item. That has a special airlift eventually. And in the meantime, he had spoken to his cronies from Changi. He'd spoken to them, and they'd gone up and they'd taken the rudder off the Shackleton that was up for disposal, and took it back to Changi and fitted it. Well, it didn't take them very long. So when the rudder, special charter, the rudder arrived, they didn't want it. So I said, that's a bit naughty. Anyway, they got a rocket in due course via the system for doing it. What they should have done was cancelled. If the rudder had fitted, they should have just cancelled it. Nothing would have been said, but it was flown out at great expense. But that was the type of thing that we were up against. It went off very well, actually. I enjoyed my tour there.
Now, what was your married quarters like?
Oh, married quarters it started off in a bungalow. Initially, when we arrived, we were in a hotel for 3 days. And then we got a bungalow in the local Chinese area, or near. I had a car by this time. I bought an old banger, a Mark II Ford Zephyr, running back and forward. My young daughter. My young daughter was five, and she went to school. The kids went to school there. They were traipsed off on a bus, you know.
Now, I want to ask you, what are you worried about? The education of your children.
The education of the kids.
Can you talk a bit about that?
The actual education was good. It was the transportation system that was bad, because depending where you were, you were either picked up early and traipsed off to school, and after school you were dropped off last, you know. And my youngest daughter wasn't too bad. They had a pretty good shuttle service, or I could pick her up and bring her home at lunchtime. She went to Salita School, and my son and daughter went to my son went to Salita School as well, as seniors, and my other daughter went to Changi School. She was the one I had the last time, but so they were tripped around on buses. It was quite secure. It was just a long day for them.
Were you happy with the quality of what they were getting?
Schooling was good. Oh yeah, better than going to the army school. Yeah, there was nothing wrong with the schooling. Then we could whilst we're on, that was when we were still out on the sticks, out in the. Then we moved to another bungalow in Thompson Road in Singapore, a bit nearer, bigger bungalow, a bit more palatial, had a garden, the fence around it. They were all hired from Chinese people, and we used to have although we had a barbed wire fence around it, the Chinese children used to come at festive times with the lanterns, and the kids loved this, and of course, My wife drove, and my youngest daughter, who was about five, well, she was five at the time, or between five and six, we had a what they called an armor, you know, a servant. And this servant had a daughter who was about 10, and she taught my youngster some Malayan words. Then we swapped the armors, and we had another armor who was about 24, couldn't speak a word of English, but we managed to teach her how to fry bacon and eggs, and they got the language. But Jalan Kayu was the name of the village, and for some reason or other, my daughter was about five. Kept on saying Jalan Kayu's, meaning that she was going to the village, and this armor thought she meant the shoes. So the shoes, her slippers or sandals, became Jalan Kayu's from that day forward. It was quite funny. But this woman had really roughed it during the occupation China in the jungle. You know. But she stayed with us for quite a while. Then the elderly lady who had the 12-year-old daughter, her husband had been in the Malayan army and was killed during a war. So she was quite good. And language problem we got over, but they looked after us quite well. We had to motor in and out to work, of course, which wasn't too bad. I had another colleague, a supply officer, who lived next door, so we were never hard up for transport. The only problem is my daughter had some, my five-year-old daughter, got some infection in her fingers, and the medics couldn't clear it, and my wife took her down to a local Chinese quack, and inside a week it was all cleared up. Really quite incredible, basically. But you were free to move around, to go and see the exhibitions, go to the markets, eat the food, even though we weren't forbidden from eating the Chinese food on the market stalls. And Salita, when we moved ultimately to Salita camp, we had a bungalow there, which was a permanent structure, again a longish building with a in a sort of quadrangle type of area. We had private gardens at the front, if you can call them gardens, which we had employ a gardener to water and keep the flowers and things going. But the back was a sort of a communal area, like a little park. And so, but nobody bothered us. We just went about our. We were lucky. This bungalow was on the main road in the camp. Maida Vale, it was called, which ran straight up through the centre of the camp to the officers' mess. So, we were on the left on the way in, and we had a little bridge, like a little Chinese style bridge across this monumental monsoon ditch, and this bridge had fan palm trees, about eight small fan palm trees, very artistic. And we had a great, in the middle of the garden, we had a frangipani tree, which is a great big, beautifully scented tree, white blossom, and the perfume was phenomenal. And round the back, at the end, we had a banana tree growing. And when I first went into this quarter, the downstairs loo was constantly, the record of servicing was about every 3 weeks. It was constantly being blocked. It was sending for the guy to come and unblock it. So when I went in, I encountered this problem for about 2 weeks, and I said, this isn't good enough. I'm not going to stay in this situation. So I sent for the guy, and I said, look, this has been a repetition. Every 3 or 4 weeks, this is blocking. There's something radically wrong with the system. So they said, yeah, there must be something wrong with it. So they eventually went round the back, and they dug up the sewer. And what had happened, there was a crack in the earthenware effluent, the pipe, and through which the roots of this banana tree. Mind you, the bananas were beautiful, beautiful bananas off this tree. But it was almost, what was happening, the roots were getting in, it was blocking the drain. So we disconnected the root, and that resolved the problem quite well.